Today, a lesson on the world's great religions and why religion matters. Stephen Prothero is a professor of religion at Boston University and author of God Is Not One, The Eight Rival Religions That Run the World and Why Their Differences Matter. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
This idea that some have that the world's religions are different paths up the same mountain or to the same God, you say, is not only not true, but you also say to suggest that the different traditions in these religions doesn't matter is dangerous. Explain that.
Well, I think it's dangerous in the sense that ignorance is always dangerous. And religion is a hugely powerful force in the world, both in American politics, but more importantly, in the Middle East, in Iran, in Sri Lanka, in Myanmar, wherever, China. And to understand the powerful force that religion has in the world, we need to understand what it really is. And I think that if you come at it with some particular ideological perspective, like the new atheists have, that all the religions are stupid and the same, or that these liberal multiculturalists have, that all the religions are the same and lovely, that it blinds us to the good and the bad in the religions. And they all have good and bad, and we need to reckon with those. And we need to reckon not only with the way that they're similar, but also with the way that they're different. So that's what I'm trying to push in this project.
And it seems there are lots of conversations or have been on the similarities, but we don't often hear about the differences.
Well, there's a weird split, because in academia, the real push over the last decade and more has been toward understanding differences. I mean, academics are into specialization,
right?
So we're saying things like, oh, there's not one Buddhism, there's many Buddhisms. You can't even talk about Buddhism, because even inside Buddhism there's so much difference. This is really kind of old hat inside academia. But the popular books on religion, which are not being written for the most part by college professors, really do tend to push this idea that the religions are all the same. They're going, or essentially the same. And when you get to the top of the mountain, it's really one thing. It may be union with God. It may be God's self. It might be compassion, whatever it might be. People have different construals of it. But that's very popular in the most popular books on religion.
And I think a lot of people think of religion as a private matter. And you say that it is not a private affair, that it matters socially, economically, politically, militarily.
Yeah, I mean, this was the thing in American politics that the Democrats were big on until, frankly, Obama, where they were saying, look, you know, the Republicans are wrong to be pushing religion into the public space. Religion is a private matter. It should stay in the home. It should stay in the churches, synagogues, and mosques. It shouldn't be out in the public space. And the, sort of this idea that it's a violation almost of American tradition or even the separation of church and state to be talking about God in public. Well, Americans have been talking about God in public from the very beginning, even from before the founding of the Republic. So this is really nothing new. But now we have both parties who are figuring that out. And obviously, if you go overseas and you look and you see, you know, how elections are determined to some extent in India by religious affiliation, the rise of the Hindu kind of fundamentalists in India is really important. And the way that the Chinese government is now substituting Confucianism essentially for Marxism and Leninism, because they realize Marxism and Leninism are failed ideologies, and this idea that they used to have in the Cultural Revolution, that Confucianism was this sort of feudal, backward, horrible thing. They're thinking, hey, you know, we can use this. This is like, this is like family values, you know, hard work, thrift, you know. Well, let's be a Confucian party.
Right. And you write, even if religion makes no sense to you, you need to make sense of religion to make sense of the world. It's a great quote.
Well, thank you. I'm proud of that. Thank you for reading it. I mean, I think what I'm responding to there is, a lot of people, whenever I write, you know, I write for a blog for CNN online at the Belief blog. And so often when I write about religion, people will write back to me or in the comment section will say, religion is stupid. You know, why are we even talking about this? There's no God. It's a bunch of fairy tales, you know. By the way, these people are a very small minority. They're vocal online, but they're maybe 2% of Americans are atheists and a lot lower worldwide. But my point is that it doesn't matter whether you're a Christian, whether you're a Muslim, whether you're an evangelical, whether you're an atheist or agnostic. It doesn't change the world. You know, you're one person. And, you know, if you look at what's going on in the Middle East, in Israel and the Palestinian territories, you know, I defy anyone to pretend that that's purely about politics and economics. Of course, it's about those things. But it's also about ancient religious understandings of what land God has given to whom. And that's part of why that conflict is so intractable. And this is true in Kashmir, where we have two nuclear powers, one, the Muslim majority state of Pakistan and the other the Hindu majority state of India, who are locked horns over this area. And you can multiply those examples all around the world.
Yeah. We're talking with Stephen Prothero. His book is God Is Not One, The Eight Rival Religions That Run the World and Why Their Differences Matter. Now, you set up this book in eight religions in order of influence and the questions they ask, which are different, and how they approach a problem.
That's right. One thing I say is that the religions aren't just giving different answers to the same question. They're not just giving different paths to salvation or something like that. They have very different sense of what the human problem is and therefore what the solution is and therefore the path to get from the problem to the mm-hmm. solution. So the only real agreement is there's something wrong with the world. I mean, you wouldn't really have a religion if it's like, hey, everything's great, you right. know, we're good here. So, for example, in Christianity, the problem is sin. Human beings are born, you know, classically Christians have affirmed with original sin. And the goal then is to get rid of sin, which is salvation. And then the question is, what are the techniques for that? And that's where Catholics and Protestants differ. And the Protestants will say, you know, faith alone. And the Catholics will say some combination of faith and good works. If you look to Buddhism, they're not trying to solve the problem of sin. When they look at the world and they say, what's the human predicament? They say the human predicament is that we suffer. Mm-hmm. And their goal is to get rid of suffering, and that's called nirvana, which is the goal of Buddhism. And then they have these different techniques, like maybe it's chanting, maybe it's meditation, maybe it's devotion to a bodhisattva, whatever it might be. But the goal is not to get to heaven. The goal is not to get salvation. It's to get rid of suffering. So one thing I push in the book to my readers is, you know, which of these problems resonates with you? Are you interested in the Confucian problem of social chaos, and do you want to get the Confucian goal of social harmony? Well, then you should listen to Confucius. He has thought about this. You know, are you interested in getting rid of suffering in your life by looking inside? Well, then you should listen to the Buddha. He's thought about this. You know, are you interested in asking the question, what must I do to be saved, like Jesus is asked in the Gospels? Then Christianity is a good religion for you.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, I'm just thinking as you're saying this, you know, religion can be, it's what speaks to you. You know, I can listen to a sermon and think, wow, that is the most moving, you know, inspirational thing I've heard. And my husband will go, really? You know, and something that he finds, right. I'm going, really?
So, right, because it taps into something yeah. in you that is, that you have that your husband doesn't have or vice mm-hmm. versa.
Right.
You know, and for one, I mean, for example, I talk about in Judaism how there's this wonderful idea of arguing on behalf of God and versus, say, arguing on behalf of ego, which is what you so often hear,
right.
you know, on the radio and on TV, where you're just trying to win, right? And right. You're not really trying to learn anything or figure something out. You're just pretending you are.
Yeah.
And therefore, in Judaism, because there's this whole tradition of debating the Talmud, this sort of the scripture in Judaism that's sort of about the law, like what to do, there's a sort of tolerance inside Judaism for ambiguity and uncertainty that I find really admirable, that I love, you know, that I didn't when I was 22, mm-hmm. you know. I was looking for certainty. I was looking right. for answers, right?
Sure.
And some people think that's sort of a cop-out. You know, I think in Christianity, especially among evangelicals, there's this idea that, like, there's all these great questions and God has given us all the answers and all we need to do is look at the Bible. And, you know, Jews will say, what does looking at the Bible help? I mean, there's so many different interpretations, right? Of our Bible and mm-hmm. surely of your Christian Bible too. And so it kind of depends on the person. You know, some people will, you know, say, if I say, you know, gosh, I love, you know, having all these questions and not having these answers, which is kind of where I am now. They'll say, oh, that's so sad. I'm so sorry for you. You know, you know, certainty is so much better. And I'm like, no, I've had certainty before. This is much, much preferred.
Well, after September 11th, a lot of people in this country started to ask questions about Muslims and Islam. But you brought an interesting note, which is Islam really burst into the modern Western conscience with the rise of Ayatollah Khomeini during the Iranian Revolution in 1979 and the capture of in Tehran of 52 U.S. diplomats.
Yeah, well, we have very short attention span in the United States.
So true, so true.
And I think that, you know, we have this amazing, I mean, it's actually one of, in some ways, I hate to admit this as a historian, one of the virtues of America, because we're constantly interested in making things new. And if you remember too much, it's sort of hard to do that. You're like, didn't we try that five times and fail? You know, maybe we shouldn't try it again. But yeah, and I remember that. I was in college and I had an Iranian roommate and he had just come over. I started college in 1978 in the Iranian Revolution. Revolution just happened right after that, and that was a real moment when people were asking about mm-hmm. Islam. You know, like what is Iran? Like, where is it on the map? And mm-hmm. oh, they're Muslims, and oh, they're Shia Muslims. Like, what is that? And who's this Ayatollah? And he seems like a pope. I didn't, you know, there was all this confusion and conversation. The 9/11 moment was different because it was here, mm-hmm. you know, and we couldn't sort of imagine like those poor guys who are, and women who are, you know, held hostage. It was more like an attack on us. And so it was sort of self-defense to learn about the
and
Quran.
And why? Yeah, why? Yeah.
Right. Why do they hate us, et cetera? Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things. And so there was even more of a push to go out and buy Qurans and, frankly, to take religious studies courses. We had so many people coming in to our classes at Boston University wanting to learn about the world's religions mm-hmm. and about Islam after that, because people realized how ignorant they were about these traditions.
And certainly so many misconceptions and just myths around it all. An interesting fact that you have in the book is most of the world's Muslim lives in Asia. You write, Indonesia has more Muslims, roughly 178 million, than any other country, three times as many as in Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, and Iraq combined. I did not know that.
Yeah, well, not many people do. I mean, we actually were hiring in my department recently for someone in Islam, and we had this great conversation because we were looking at someone whose specialty was Islam in India. And some people were saying, like, what the heck, you know, like... Mm-hmm. Islam's a Middle Eastern religion, and some of us are saying, no, it's an Asian religion. You know, at least in origins, mm-hmm. it's Middle Eastern. But, you know, only about 20% of Muslims in the world speak Arabic, and the Quran is written in Arabic, and the Quran needs to stay in Arabic in order to be the Quranic. Translations of the Quran are not really scriptural. But yeah, I've been to Indonesia, and I've talked to Muslims. I talk to a lot of Muslims in Indonesia. And they have a very different understanding of Islam, certainly, than what we imagine about mm-hmm. the sort of kind of hardcore Muslim extremists. You know, very few women there are even veiled at all, mm-hmm. Even in rural areas. There's a kind of religious tolerance built into Islam, even into the Quran, about Christians and Jews being people of the book and Muslims joining them in that, in the sense that, hey, we all have the same God. Mm-hmm. God speaks to us through prophets. We write to have scriptures. Well, your scriptures are corrupted and ours isn't. That's a difference. But in Indonesia, they extend that even to Buddhists and Hindus. It's very interesting, you know, because, you know, Bali, which is Hindu, is part of Indonesia. And there's a lot of Buddhist influence. And they'll say, hey, even Buddhists and Hindus are people of the book. You know, they're sort of in our group of people who kind of get the basic idea about God.
Yeah. We're talking with Stephen Prothero. His book is God Is Not One. Let's talk about jihad. It means struggle, but I guess what kind of struggle is debated? That word is so debated.
Right. Well, you know, I think this is a place where I try to find a middle ground, and where I think I do, because it's there. There are sort of two parties on this. One says, the kind of neocon group who's trying to make Islam into this dangerous religion will say, well, jihad is actually one of the pillars of Islam, you know, one of the core practices, which isn't true. But then they'll also say that jihad means holy war. You know, jihad is, yes, it means struggle, but it means the external struggle against the enemies of Islam. But then there's another camp that says, no, it doesn't mean that at all. It means inner struggle. It's the struggle against the demons inside each of us, you know. And I think the reality is, should be clear to anyone who looks at this with some care, is that it's both. I mean, Muslims have read it both ways. It's not like every Muslim in every Muslim society has understood jihad to be purely inner struggle. That's just not true. You know, the guys who flew those jets into the World Trade Center, they thought they were doing jihad. They thought they were doing holy war on behalf of God. So it's not just inner struggle, but neither is it just external struggle. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very clear in the literature that it also means inner. And for most people, that's what it's, throughout Muslim history, that's what it has largely been. But I think that one thing I try to do in the book is to reckon with both the good and the bad, the troublesome and the beautiful mm-hmm. pieces of each religion. And to do that, you need to look at sections of scripture, exemplars that are troubling, and I try to do that by looking at both sides of jihad.
You say Muslims have been reluctant to translate the Quran, but Christians not so. There's the willingness to be open to local beliefs and practices, which is one of the keys to Christianity's global success. Something I hadn't thought about, but it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. It's really weird, actually, in America, that when somebody opens a Bible in English, it's just like the Bible.
Yeah,
and you know, when you translate something, you change it. And if it's the word of God and you've, I mean, none of the books of the Bible were written in English. You know, I'm sure your smart listeners know that. Mm-hmm. But there isn't this sense of something lost. There isn't a sense of tragedy in a way that, oh, man. You know, and actually early on in America, a lot of public schools used to teach Hebrew and Greek because they wanted their kids to be able to read the Bible. And they had to read Hebrew and Greek to understand the Bible because that's the language it was written in, right? The languages it was written in. With the Quran, as I mentioned earlier, there is this idea that it's only scripture in Arabic, and actually what were prohibitions inside Islam until pretty recently, 100 years ago or so, to not really translate into other languages because a Quran in English is not the Quran. And so when I talk in the book and I say, oh, I read the Quran, I'm saying, well, it wasn't really the Quran because I didn't read it in Arabic because I don't speak Arabic or read Arabic. But this does make it trickier because there's sort of a push to Arabize, as it were, Muslims in Indonesia. They're not reading, or in Asia, right? Because they're not reading the right scripture. But there isn't a push in the Christian world to teach people Greek and Hebrew so they can read their own Bible. And that does help indigenize the religion. And I think it does provide a competitive advantage to Christianity in terms of mission.
In the book, The 100, a ranking of the most influential persons in history, the top spot went to Muhammad. Controversial choice, but you say there's an argument to be made there.
No, I think that's totally true. I'm totally convinced by the argument. I was surprised when I read it too, but I think it makes sense. The argument is, the other guy is Jesus, right?
Right.
So, you know, that's at least what people will argue. And interesting, by the way, that it's not Winston Churchill or Abraham Lincoln, right, or even Gandhi, right? It's not a political leader, although Gandhi was, of course, both political and religious. But, the main reason, the argument for Muhammad is that Muhammad was not only the vehicle through which the revelation came into the world, where the angel Gabriel is said to have spoken to Muhammad, and then Muhammad recites what he hears, and then it's written down later. But he's also a social leader, a legislator, a jurist, and a political and military man. He's a general who leads armies, who takes territory. So he's kind of Jesus in terms of being the kind of charismatic early founder, but then he's also like Paul in terms of spreading the religion. You know, Paul spread it around the Mediterranean in the early Christian movement. And then he's kind of like Constantine, who's taking the religion and making it sort of the law of the land. So he's doing three jobs that in Christianity were done by three different people. Yeah. And I think he's definitely the most influential figure in world history.
You're right. It is often a mistake to refer to a religion as a faith or to its adherents as believers. As odd as this might sound, faith and belief don't matter much in most religions.
Yeah, you're picking up my good ones.
Oh, good.
My good quotes. You know, this kind of drives me crazy. People do use the word faith and it's useful because as a writer, you know, people who talk on the radio, you know, you need synonyms for stuff, right? So you hate to keep saying religion, religion, religion. So it's nice to be able to say faith. A lot of my students will say, oh, belief system, you know, religion. And I just say, religions are not belief systems. You know, this is, I think, a place where our bias towards Christianity and particularly towards Protestantism is really palpable because Protestantism is about faith. That's the polemic against the Catholics, right? You Catholics think you can get to heaven by good works. Well, Jesus didn't have to die then if you can get to heaven by good works. You get to heaven only by faith, salvation by faith through grace. And so they will say, Protestants will say, religion's about faith. It's about this inner turn of the heart, right? And so it makes sense for Protestants to say, this is my faith. But Buddhists will say, this has nothing to do with faith. And they, in conversation with Christians, they'll say, listen, here's what we say. Try this meditation practice. See if it eliminates your suffering. If it does, just keep doing it. If it doesn't, don't. And they say, it's experimental. It has nothing to do with faith. Zero, zero. It's like a science experiment. And to call it faith is to mistake what it is. Similarly, I think Islam has an element of faith, but it's mostly about, the word means submission. It's mostly about doing the things that you're supposed to do. Same with Judaism. There's an element of faith, but it's mostly about following the law and telling the story. So I try with each of these religions in the book to talk about the things that they hold most dear. Faith is held dear in Protestantism, but it's not held dear in any of the other religions that I talk about in God Is Not One.
Yeah. Confucianism, you say, is grouped alongside Taoism and Buddhism as one of China's three teachings.
Yeah, what's really interesting about China is, you know, we have these surveys. I was involved with one recently by the Pew Foundation. It's coming out in September, I believe. It's actually about religious literacy in America, how little Americans know about religion, which was the subject of my last book. And one of the things they ask in that survey and in so many surveys is, what is your religion? Mm-hmm. The assumption is singular, right? What is your one religion? And that's a monotheistic legacy. You know, if the gods are fighting and there's only one god that's true, then you have to pick sides, right? But in China, the three teachings of Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism, most people in China, or many people in China, are all three. And even those who are Christians are also Confucians, even though sometimes they don't know it. And so there's this way that the religions get along and sort of have like separate spheres, you know? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the old 19th century notion of men and women in separate spheres. You know, the women are in the home and the men are out in the public space, right? And so there's a saying in China that, you know, you're a Confucian at work and you're a Taoist on the weekend and you're a Buddhist at death, because the Confucianism will tell you how to interact with your ruler and with your boss. And the Taoist will tell you, like, go wander in the woods by yourself and discover your own naturalness and simplicity and freedom. And then the Buddhists are the ones who guide you through your rebirth mm-hmm. at death. And so you need the monk there, you know, to put you to rest so you'll have a good rebirth. So they're kind of all three rather than one.
And it's interesting because I've had people say who practice Buddhism say Buddhism is not a religion. I'm Catholic, but I'm also Buddhist.
Right. Yeah. Well, see, the reason they say that is because they know that Catholicism doesn't allow you to have another religion.
Right.
So they have to pretend that it's not.
Good point.
It's similar with Nikki Haley, who just won the runoff for governor in South Carolina. She was raised a Sikh. She converted, perhaps for political reasons, perhaps not, to Christianity. Initially on her websites and when she was running for various political offices, she kind of said she was both a Sikh and a Christian. Mm-hmm. And finally, in this election for governor, the hammer came down. It's like, no, you can't
be one.
Right. And so now she's like, no, I'm just a Christian. I'm just a Christian.
The other religions that you cover in the book are Hinduism, Judaism, and one I never heard of, Yoruba.
Yeah, that's right. It's the one of the great religions of the world that a lot of people have never heard of, the Yoruba religion. It starts in Nigeria. It's also, which is in West Africa, it's also, you can find it in Benin and Togo. And then it moves through the slave trade to Brazil, South America, Central America, and in the United States, in places now like Miami, New York City, most big cities in America with large African-American populations. It's a religion that attacks the problem of, and I love this, disconnection.
Mm-hmm.
We're disconnected from our own destiny. And because we're disconnected from our destiny, we're disconnected from our community. And because we're disconnected from our community, we're disconnected from the cosmos and the powers that are in it, divine and otherwise. And so the goal then is to reconnect us with our destiny. And the way you do that is through a kind of casting of nuts, or sort of like throwing dice kind of thing, mm-hmm. where there's these 256 possible combinations come up. And then the master of the mysteries of destiny, who's kind of like a priest, can tell you the stories associated with each of those numbers. And you then, through listening to those stories, can reconnect with your own destiny and reconnect with the powers in the world through sacrifice and things like that. It's a really fascinating religion.
And you do have a chapter on atheism, even though it's a minority.
I do have, I call it a brief coda because it's it's half as long as the other chapters. Mm. And I take up the question there of like whether atheism is a religion, why atheism is so popular in the media and so unpopular among ordinary Americans, where, like I say, only about 2% are atheists. But I think it's part of the religion conversation, so I wanted to have it in the book.
There was an interesting thing you talk about in the conclusion of the book, and it's about a Chicago-based interfaith youth corps run by, is it Eboh Patel? Did I say that right?
Eboh, yes.
Eboh Patel, mm-hmm. who actively discourages the kids from discussing politics and theology and instead sets them to work on community projects and encourages them to discuss how their very different traditions impel them toward a shared commitment to service. What a bright guy.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. I talk about that as interfaith 2.0. You know, the old interfaith thing was a bunch of older people getting in a room to talk and to basically talk just about what they agreed on, which I always thought was a kind of pretend pluralism, a kind of really more of a monologue than an interfaith dialogue. And Eboh's, who, by the way, is on President Obama's faith-based council, and I was actually at a conference with him just a couple weeks ago in the White House on interfaith service on college campuses, and he's a dynamo. And the idea really is the religions are different. Mm-hmm. Let's not pretend they're the same, but we can all help other people. Let's do that. And he is able to get Orthodox Jews, conservative Jews, evangelical Christians, Catholics, and Muslims, which he's a Muslim, and many other people, Hindus and Buddhists, and secular people, to get together to do, you know, to do good. And it's a really great model. And as they're doing good, they often end up talking, and they don't feel like they're supposed to just pretend that they're all the same, and they're able to talk about their differences. It's a really nice institution.
And not want to kill each other.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I love what you wrote at the end in the acknowledgments. You wrote, quote, "I view teaching and learning as conversation and conversation as provocation. I'm happy to report that the conversations my students have with me and with one another in my classrooms over the years have been all the provocation any professor could desire. I thank them above all else for asking big questions, the sort of questions that no one book and no one religion can exhaust." So we go back to your questions. You have more questions than answers.
Yeah, that's right. And I love the idea that religions, rather than repositories of dogma, are repositories of questions. And to dig for me into these great religions of the world is to dig into these wonderful questions that have been asked for millennia, have been debated for millennia, and that we don't have simple answers for. And that doesn't trouble me. That just kind of excites me.
Yeah. I imagine you get a lot of inspiration from your students, too, because that's always such a, you know, the conversations that happen in classrooms are really amazing.
Well, I know that, one thing that I say in the book is that especially into religion classes and philosophy classes too, students come with these amazing, like, big questions, like, what's my purpose in life? What happens when I die? You know, is there a God? You know, all these. And then we're like nerds, you know, we channel them into these simple questions like, you know, when was Constantine born? Or like, when did the Eastern Orthodox Church split off from the Roman Catholic Church? Like, who cares, you know, about, I mean, those are things we can test them on, right? Mm-hmm. And I try as best as I can in my world religions course, which is called Death and Immortality, to keep these big questions alive, you know.
Stephen Prothero's book is God Is Not One, The Eight Rival Religions That Run the World and Why Their Differences Matter. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is hosted and produced by Mindy Todd. The executive producer is Steve Young. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.